October 7th. Israelis were protesting to prevent Netanyahu's abolition of judicial independence. The religious bigots and Zionist fanatics currently in power had mounted a determined attack on secularism. Israel's unity since the attack is precarious. It is a negative unity. It is held together by hatred. Hatred is a dangerous political commodity. Once finished with one enemy, those who stoke hatred go in search of another. The Palestinian, quote-unquote, human animals, when eradicated or subdued, will be replaced by disloyal Palestinians with Israeli citizenship already targeted by a series of discriminatory laws, along with Jewish apostates and traitors. The demonized group can never be redeemed or cured. A politics of hatred creates a permanent instability that is exploited by those seeking the destruction of civil society. The Israeli scholar Yeshayahu Leibowitz, who Isaiah Berlin called the conscience of Israel, warned that, quote, if Israel did not separate church and state, it would give rise to a corrupt rabbinate that would warp Judaism into a fascistic cult. Religious nationalism is to religion what national socialism was to socialism, warned Leibowitz, who died in 1994. He understood that the blind veneration of the military, especially after the 1967 war, was dangerous and would lead to the ultimate destruction of democracy. Our situation will deteriorate to that of a second Vietnam, to a war and constant escalation without prospect of ultimate resolution, he wrote. He foresaw that the Arabs would be the working people and the Jews the administrators, inspectors, officials, and police, mainly secret police. A state ruling a hostile population of 1.5 million to 2 million foreigners would necessarily become a secret police state, with all that implies for education, free speech, and democratic institutions. The corruption characteristic of every colonial regime would also prevail in the state of Israel. The administration would have to suppress Arab insurgency on the one hand and acquire Arab Quislings on the other. There is also good reason to fear that the Israel Defense Force, which has been until now a people's army, would as a result of being transformed into an army of occupation, and its commanders will become military governors, will resemble their colleagues in other nations. He saw the rise of virulent racism that would consume Israeli society. He knew that prolonged occupation of the Palestinians would spawn, in his words, concentration camps for the occupied, and as he wrote, Israel would not deserve to exist, and it would not be worthwhile to preserve it. Jews, he understood, can also become Pharaoh. The decision to obliterate Gaza has long been the dream of Israeli fanatics, heirs of the fascistic movement led by the extremist Meir Kahana, who I knew and covered, who was barred from running for office and whose Koch party was outlawed in 1994 and declared a terrorist organization by Israel and the United States. They champion the iconography and language of their homegrown fascism. Jewish identity and Jewish nationalism are the Zionist versions of blood and soil. Jewish supremacy is sanctified by God, as is the slaughter of the Palestinians, who are compared to the biblical Amalekites massacred by the Israelis. Enemies, usually Muslims, slated for extinction are subhuman. Violence and the threat of violence are the only forms of communication those outside the magic circle of Jewish nationalism understand. Millions of Muslims and Christians, including those with Israeli citizenship, are to be purged. The Biden presidency, which ironically may have signed its own political death certificate, is tethered to Israel's genocide. It tries to distance itself rhetorically, but at the same time it funnels billions of dollars of weapons demanded by Israel, including $14.3 billion in supplemental military aid to augment the $3.8 billion in annual aid to, quote-unquote, finish the job. It is a full partner in Israel's genocidal project. There is no way to deny the courage of the armed Palestinian resistance, whether you accept their ideology or not, as they face down one of the most advanced military machines on the planet with little more than small arms. But there are also other forms of resistance that, to me, are as important. Writers, poets, journalists, and photographers, many of whom have been targeted and killed by Israel, affirm the belief that one day, a day the writers, journalists, and photographers may never see, the words and images will provoke empathy, understanding, outrage, and provide wisdom. They chronicle not only the facts, although the facts are important, but the texture, sacredness, and grief of lives and communities lost. They tell the world what this genocide is like, how those caught in its maw of death endure, how there are those who sacrifice for others and those who do not, what fear and hunger are like, what death is like. They transmit the cries of the children, the wails of grief of the mothers, the daily struggle in the face of savage industrial violence, the triumph of their humanity through filth, sickness, humiliation, and fear. This is why writers, photographers, and journalists are targeted by aggressors in war, including the Israelis. They stand as witnesses to evil, and evil the aggressors want buried and forgotten. They expose the lies. They condemn, even from the grave, their killers. Israel has killed at least 13 Palestinian poets and writers, along with over 83 journalists and media workers in Gaza, and 3 in Lebanon since October 7th. And this brings me to the Palestinian novelist and playwright, Atif Abu Saif. He and his 15-year-old son, Yasser, who live in the occupied West Bank, were visiting family in Gaza, where he was born, when Israel began its scorched earth campaign. Atif is no stranger to the violence of the Israeli occupiers. He was two months old during the 1973 war and writes, "I've been living through wars ever since. Just as life is a pause between two deaths, Palestine as a place and as an idea is a timeout in the middle of many wars." During Operation Cast Lead, the 2008-2009 Israeli assault on Gaza, if Atif sheltered in the corridor of his Gaza family home for 22 nights with his wife, Hannah, and 2 children, while Israel bombed and shelled. His book, The Drone Eats With Me, Diaries from a City Under Fire, is an account of Operation Protective Edge, the 2014 Israeli assault on Gaza that killed 1,523 Palestinian civilians, including 519 children. Memories of war can be strangely positive because to have them at all means you must have survived, he notes sardonically. He did what writers do, including the professor and poet Rifat Al-Arir, who was killed, along with Rifat's brother, sister, and her 4 children in an airstrike on his sister's apartment in Gaza on December 7th. Atif, once again, finding himself living amid the explosions and carnage from Israeli shells and bombs, doggedly publishes his observations and reflections. His accounts are often difficult to transmit because of Israel's blockage of internet and phone service. On the first day of the Israeli bombardment, a friend, a young poet and musician, Omar Abu Shawish, is killed, apparently an Israeli naval bombardment, though later reports would say he was killed in an airstrike as he was walking to work. Atif wonders about the Israeli soldiers watching him and his family with their infrared lenses and satellite photography. "Can they count the loaves of bread in my basket or the number of falafel balls on my plate?" he wonders. He watches the crowds of dazed and confused families, their homes in rubble, carrying mattresses, bags of clothes, food, and drink. He stands mutely before the supermarket, the bureau de change, the falafel shop, the fruit stalls, the perfume parlor, the sweet shop, the toy shop, all burned. Blood was everywhere, along with bits of kids' toys, cans from the supermarket, smashed fruit, broken bicycles, and shattered perfume bottles, he writes. The place looked like a charcoal drawing of a town scorched by a dragon. I noticed that Ramadan decorations were still hanging in the street. The city has become a wasteland of rubble and debris, Atif, who has been the Palestinian Authority's Minister of Culture since 2019, writes in the early days of the Israeli shelling. Beautiful buildings fall like columns of smoke. I often think about the time I was shot as a kid during the first intifada and how my mother told me I actually died for a few minutes before being brought back to life. Maybe I can do the same this time, I think. He leaves his teenage son with family members. The Palestinian logic is that in wartime we should all sleep in different places, so that if part of the family is killed, another part lives, he writes. The UN schools are getting more crowded with displaced families. The hope is that the UN flag will save them, though in previous wars this hasn't been the case. On Tuesday, October 17th, he writes, I see death approaching, hear its steps growing louder. Just to be done with it, I think. It's the 11th day of the conflict, but all the days have merged into one. The same bombardment, the same fear, the same smell. On the news, I read the names of the dead on the ticker at the bottom of the screen. I wait for my name to appear. In the morning, my phone rang. It was Rula, a relative in the West Bank, telling me she had heard there'd been an airstrike at Talat Hawa, a neighborhood on the south side of Gaza City, where my cousin Hatem lives. Hatem is married to Huda, my wife's only sister. He lives in a four-story building that houses his mother and brothers and their families. I called around, but no one's phone was working. I walked to Al-Shifa Hospital to read the names. Lists of the dead are pinned up daily outside a makeshift morgue. I could barely approach the building. Thousands of Gazans had made the hospital their home, its gardens, its hallways. Every empty space or spare corner had a family in it. I gave up and headed toward Hatem's. 30 minutes later, I was on his street. Rula had been right. Huda and Hatem's building had been hit only an hour earlier. The bodies of their daughter and grandchild had already been retrieved. The only known survivor was Wissam, one of their other daughters, who had been taken to the ICU. Wissam had gone straight into surgery, where both of her legs and her right hand had been amputated. Her graduation ceremony from art college had taken place only the day before. She has to spend the rest of her life without legs, with one hand. What about the others? I asked someone. We can't find them, came the reply. Amid the rubble, we shouted, Hello! Can anyone hear us? We called out the names of those still missing, hoping some might still be alive. By the end of the day, we managed to find 5 bodies, including that of a 3-month-old. We went to the cemetery to bury them. In the evening, I went to see Wissam in the hospital. She was barely awake. After half an hour, she asked me, Uncle, I'm dreaming, right? I said, We are all in a dream. My dream is terrifying. Why? All our dreams are terrifying. After 10 minutes of silence, she said, Don't lie to me, Uncle. In my dream, I don't have legs. It's true, isn't it? I have no legs. But you said it's a dream. I don't like this dream, Uncle. I had to leave. For a long 10 minutes, I cried and cried. Overwhelmed by the horrors of the past few days, I walked out of the hospital and found myself wandering the streets. I thought idly, we could turn this city into a film set for war movies, Second World War films and end of the world movies. We could hire it out to the best Hollywood directors. Doomsday on demand. Who could have the courage to tell Hannah, so far away in Ramallah, that her only sister had been killed, that her family had been killed? I phoned my colleague, Manar, and asked her, to go to our house with a couple of friends and try to delay the news from getting to her. Lie to her, I told Manar. Say the building was attacked by F-16s, but the neighbors think Huda and Hatem were out at the time. Any lie that could help. Leaflets in Arabic dropped by Israeli helicopters float down from the sky. They announce that anyone who remains north of the Wadi waterway will be considered a partner to terrorism, meaning, Atif writes, the Israelis can shoot on sight. The electricity is cut, food, fuel, and water run out. The wounded are operated on without anesthesia. There are no painkillers or sedatives. He visits his niece, Wissam, racked with pain in Al-Shifa Hospital, who asks him for a lethal injection. She says Allah will forgive her. But he will not forgive me, Wissam. I'm going to ask him to, on your behalf, she says. After airstrikes, he joins the rescue teams under the cricket-like hum of drones we couldn't see in the sky. A line from T.S. Eliot, a heap of broken images, runs through his head. The injured and the dead are transported on three-wheeled bicycles or dragged along in carts by animals. We picked up pieces of mutilated bodies and gathered them on a blanket. You find a leg here, a hand there, while the rest looks like minced meat, he writes. In the past week, many Gazans have started writing their names on their hands and legs in pen or permanent marker so they can be identified when death comes. This might seem macabre, but it makes perfect sense. We want to be remembered. We want our stories to be told. We seek dignity. At the very least, our names will be on our graves. The smell of unretrieved bodies under the ruins of a house hit last week remains in the air. The more time passes, the stronger the smell. The scenes around him become surreal. On November 19th, day 44 of the assault, he writes, a man rides a horse toward me with the body of a dead teenager slung over the saddle in front. It seems it's his son, perhaps. It looks like a scene from a historical movie, only the horse is weak and barely able to move. He is back from no battle. He is no knight. His eyes are full of tears as he holds the little riding crop in one hand and the bridle in the other. I have an impulse to photograph him, but then feel suddenly sick at the idea. He salutes no one. He barely looks up. He is too consumed with his own loss. Most people are using the camp's old cemetery. It's the safest. And although it is technically long since full, they have started digging shallower graves and burying the dead on top of the old, keeping families together, of course. On November 21st, after constant tank shelling, he decides to flee the Jabalia neighborhood in the north of Gaza for the south with his son and mother-in-law, who is in a wheelchair. They must pass through Israeli checkpoints, where soldiers randomly select men and boys from the line for detention. Scores of bodies are strewn along both sides of the road, he writes, rotting, it seems, into the ground. The smell is horrendous. A hand reaches out toward us from the window of a burned-out car, as if asking for something, from me specifically. I see what looks like two headless bodies in a car, limbs and precarious body parts just thrown away and left to fester. He tells his son Yasser, don't look, just keep walking, son. In early December, his family home is destroyed in an airstrike. The house a writer grows up in is a well from which to draw material. In each of my novels, whenever I wanted to depict a typical house in the camp, I conjured ours. I'd move the furniture around a bit, change the name of the alley, but who was I kidding? It was always our house. All the houses in Jabalia are small. They're built randomly, haphazardly, and they're not made to last. These houses replace the tents that Palestinians, like my grandmother, Aisha, lived in after the displacements of 1948. Those who built them always thought they'd soon be returning to the beautiful, spacious homes they left behind in the towns and villages of historic Palestine. That return never happened, despite our many rituals of hope, like safeguarding the key to the old family home. The future keeps betraying us, but the past is ours. Though I've lived in many cities around the world and visited many more, that tiny ramshackle abode was the only place I ever felt at home, he goes on. Friends and colleagues always asked, why don't you live in Europe or America? You have the opportunity. My students chimed in, why did you return to Gaza? My answer was always the same. Because in Gaza, in an alleyway, in the Saftawi neighborhood of Jabalia, there stands a little house that cannot be found anywhere else in the world. If on doomsday, God were to ask me where I would like to be sent, I wouldn't hesitate in saying, home. Now, there is no home. Atif, as I write, is trapped in southern Gaza with his son. His niece was transferred to a hospital in Egypt, and Atif continues to write. We are called, as believers, Muslims, Christians, and Jews, to stand with the oppressed. We are called to defy malignant power. Atif, Rifat, and those like them who speak to us at the risk of death, remind us of this injunction. They speak, so we will not be silent. They speak, so we will take these words and images and hold them up to the principalities of the world, the media, politicians, diplomats, universities, the wealthy and privileged, the weapons manufacturers, the Pentagon, and the Israel lobby, and demand that this genocide cease. The Biden administration is playing a very cynical game. It insists it is trying to halt what, by its own admission, is Israel's indiscriminate bombing of Palestinians while bypassing Congress to speed up the supply of weapons to Israel, including dumb bombs. It insists it wants the fighting in Gaza to end while it vetoes ceasefire resolutions at the UN. It insists it upholds the rule of law while it subverts the legal mechanism at the International Court of Justice that can halt the genocide. The ICJ is a UN body, and whatever ruling it makes, even on a temporary injunction saying, you know, there's enough evidence, it has to be approved by the Security Council, and the U.S. will veto it. So it's moot. And let's just, by the way, honor South Africa. They have stood with the Palestinians for decades. But if the core, and you can be sure there will be heavy pressure from the U.S., one, not to issue, in essence, a temporary injunction saying there's enough evidence. They won't rule at first on whether there's genocide. They'll just say there's enough evidence to bring the case, therefore it should stop. We know there will be heavy, heavy pressure because under international law, if there is a ruling that Israel is committing genocide, the United States is guilty, which it is guilty, of accomplice to genocide. Cynicism pervades every word. Biden, Blinken, Jake Sullivan, and Brett McGurk, the four horsemen of the apocalypse who support this genocide utter. This cynicism extends to us. Our revulsion for Donald Trump, the Biden White House believes, will impel us to keep Biden in office. On any other issue, this might be the case, but it cannot be the case with genocide. Genocide is not a political problem. It is a moral one. We cannot, no matter what the cost, support those who commit or are accomplices to genocide, even if it means we are forced to endure the dreaded return of Trump. Genocide is the crime of all crimes. It is the purest expression of evil. We must stand unequivocally with the Palestinians. We must demand justice. We must hold Biden accountable. If we do not, we join the long list of those who, for expediency or because of indifference, have sold out the Palestinians and sold out all of the oppressed. I read from the Hadith collection of Imam al-Bukhari. He writes, "The Prophet, peace be upon him, once said to us, Help your brother, the oppressor and the oppressed. We asked, O messenger of God, we understand how we can help when oppressed. But how should we help one who is oppressing? By stopping him from oppressing others, he replied. Evil has not changed down the millenniums, but neither has goodness. Thank you.
You were just listening to Chris Hedges on Biden, the Gaza genocide, and Israel. He spoke at the Islamic Society for Central New Jersey in Monmouth Junction on January 18th. Chris Hedges is an award-winning independent reporter and the author of many books. His latest is The Greatest Evil is War. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Richard Falk, Ilan Pape, Norman Finkelstein, Phyllis Bennis, and Medea Benjamin. And we have a series of Chris Hedges programs. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Chris Hedges on Biden, the Gaza genocide, and Israel, and for his book, The Greatest Evil is War, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
Hello, this is Boris Chassin. To get a feel on what's happening across the country, listen to Viewpoints. For reports, interviews, and documentaries on politics, arts and culture, the environment, housing, and more. Thanks to 30 journalists stationed in the Canadian provinces and territories. Local news nationwide. Mondays at 4:30 p.m. on CJSF 90.1 FM and streaming online at cjsf.ca.
Dear listeners, as you may have heard, Meta, which owns Instagram and Facebook, is blocking Canadian access to all content created by news providers, including this radio station, in response to the Online Broadcasting Act. Access to local news and information matters to everyone, and while radio stations use their airwaves to keep you informed, we also use social media to share local news, events, and initiatives, and even content about our upcoming programming. We need you to write your MP and convey your concerns. Learn more and find a letter template for your MP on our website. Thank you for your support.
Does your mother say, ow, ow, I hate it?
Take a look in the mirror and you'll see.
Is this really me?
Sure, it takes one back to make it look like this.
I'm a dirty old witch. I'm a dirty old witch.